Welcome to Air Quality Matters, and this is a conversation with Francesca Brady. CEO and co-founder of Aerated, an indoor air quality certification company, she is an advisory member for the Camden Clean Air Initiative, the BREEAM Health and Wellbeing Technical Group, and a member of the International Well Building Institute's COVID-19 Task Force. A rising star in air quality in many ways, including on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in 2021 for her work with Aerated. With a Master's in Environmental Geoscience, specialising in indoor atmospheric chemistry, she was formerly Head of Research for Aerated and was promoted to the role of CEO in 2020. Since then, she has been dedicated to promoting and educating audiences from all walks of life about the importance, benefits, and management of good indoor air quality. She's focused on improving air quality and discussing the best ways to foster healthier living and working environments. I always enjoy talking to Francesca. She is a top-tier communicator and is able to frame a complex subject in ways that's resonating with the audience clearly. Aerated is a standard with a laser focus on air quality and is growing in recognition year on year under her leadership. We discussed the value of labelling air quality in buildings and the challenges around building the business case, how Aerated is approaching the sector and creating accessible on-ramps for all classes of buildings, how air quality impacts performance, the bottom line, ESG, and so much more. I hope you enjoy this one. Thanks for listening as always. This is Francesca Brady. Why label a building at all for something like air quality? What's driving decisions within businesses to do that?
I honestly think it's a couple of things, because I'm sure back in the day, people are like, well, why would we start labeling the energy performance of a building? It is one of those things you can't see. It is fundamentally important to understand. With an EPC, it was important from an operational perspective to understand. With air quality, yes, it's important from an operational perspective, but it's also important from a health and well-being of the people coming into the space. So the employer slash occupier, but also the employees. So I think it is one of those metrics where you're like, well, we probably should, and we should be transparent about this, but there's no mandatory requirement like there is for an EPC. So it tends to be those who know that they've probably got a good building that will choose to do it. But then that starts to get attention, generates awareness, and then others think, okay, is this something that is going to either be a mandatory requirement, or are people going to ask why we don't have it? Because the building next door's got one, so why don't we have one? So it's one of those things where, yeah, you don't have to label it right now, but why wouldn't you? And I'm sure this is going to go the same way as EPCs. Energy performance certificate, air quality performance certificate.
And you're seeing that with a lot of these other energy-based labels like LEED and BREEAM increasingly including more and more air quality parameters to their labels, aren't you? So it's clear that's the direction of travel.
Yeah, and with a lot of them, it was a token gesture to begin with. So it was like, oh, we'll throw something in there about indoor air quality. Maybe it is a kind of light touch check, a light touch test, or maybe it's just a policy requirement. And now more and more of them are wanting to do more with it, but we're also seeing them seek the expertise from the air quality industry, because we're all here and we're all ready and willing to help. They're going out and they're seeking these kind of expert groups, so an expert air quality group. So, and there's quite a specific example. So Fitwel have version 2.1 that is still in progress at the moment. They're coming out with version 3. They went out into the air quality industry and said, we're not specifically air quality experts. We're going to need your help because we want to make more of this air quality section. It was pretty prominent anyway that they wanted to explore where there were gaps missing and all that sort of stuff. So that is going to be seen when version 3 launches, but it's really positive, and particularly from their point of view, well fit well. They are healthy building certifications, so they can't not. They have to include air quality, and it has to be a fundamental part of what they're doing. because it is a fundamental determining factor for human health. With LEED and with BREEAM, it's there and it features. It doesn't feature heavily, but I think that's okay. It's okay if a building is going for LEED and it's also doing a healthy building certification, regardless of which one that is, because the two can work in harmony, and they should work in harmony, and having both certifications validates that the two are working in harmony. You don't need to have a certification that does everything. You need to have a select few certifications that work together to form this picture of performance, and performance being everything from sustainability to health.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I've been meaning to ask you, actually, like, if you could have a do-over of the last 3 years, would you have taken COVID or not from an awareness perspective? Clearly, there was an acceleration in awareness of air quality in the built environment because of the pandemic. But you also get the sense it really took organizations down some rabbit holes and down some dead ends, and also was incredibly distracting for organizations. And any plan you had to slowly build awareness over time was thrown out the window when something like that comes around. Like, if you could write the script from 2019, would it have included COVID, do you think? And I don't, you know, obviously nobody wants a global pandemic. You know, we're not, you know, I preface that. But, you know.
It's as like brand awareness for indoor air quality.
Yeah.
It's such a good question, because on the one hand, it captured the attention of the population that ordinarily it probably wouldn't have registered with. So, and this is the problem, because there's almost like this this awareness that was generated on an individual level, so with us as people, and that is perfectly fine. But in terms of decision making, yes, the kind of mass awareness helps drive change, but it is quite slow. Where it came to business decision makers, regardless of whether it was COVID or productivity benefits, it all came down to economic benefit. So there was a, with Joseph Allen and John McComber before COVID, and all of the work they were doing around indoor air quality, ventilation, and economic commercial advantage for organizations, that was such a compelling business case in itself. And we've kind of reverted back to that anyway. So it feels like you're right. And a distraction is the right phrase to use. It does sort of feel like the last 3 years were a distraction. Investment, and quite a lot of investment, went into a lot of stuff to address COVID, but not necessarily the right stuff. So it felt in so many ways knee-jerk, responsey. And it was like, oh my God, okay, we have to show that we're doing something. Let's just do the first thing that we see on the first page of Google, and we'll just invest in that. So there was a lot of investment that could have been used better, I think, that has been used in the past 3 years to address COVID. The business case has done a complete 180 and come back to where it was before COVID. So it's back to, what is the economic benefit? What's the bottom line advantage? What's the productivity angle? All that sort of stuff. And health still features, but you have to position health in the economic benefit arena. Otherwise, you just don't really get the attention or the specific investment you need to make those improvements in the internal environment. So yeah, the last 3 years, would we have wanted COVID for the indoor air quality scene? No, I think it was too much of a distraction. I think it was getting there anyway. I know lots of people suggest it was a catalyst. So it's bought the attention and awareness it deserves, and it would have taken 5 or 10 years to get otherwise. I just don't think it's necessarily put anything in the best light either, because it's also made it very scary. So people are, indoor air quality, I'm going to associate that with COVID and all those horrible lockdowns and the deaths and all that sort of stuff. And air quality, air pollution, indoors and outdoors is terrifying enough when you think that you can't really control what you breathe a lot of the time. So it's trying to make it less scary. It's trying to educate people, because there was a huge amount of awareness and it was plastered all over mainstream media. So awareness was accelerating at a rate that education wasn't. So what you had was this point where people were aware, but they didn't really know what they were aware about. Or it's like, okay, I get like indoor air quality is a thing. I get that that's a thing now. I am aware of it. I don't understand it though. And it's the same with so many things that come into mainstream media. You're aware of them. Do you understand them? Maybe not.
Yeah. And time will tell if one of the drivers for businesses and organizations making decisions to think and categorize the quality of their building performance will be driven from the bottom up by staff awareness. And almost certainly there's an element of it, but it's unclear whether that's manifesting in a business decision to do something yet. But there is as you say, a very strong business case for thinking about air quality in the workplace, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, and it's multifaceted, because the business case is different. And I'm going to say it's different depending on what department you're in. So, which might sound a bit strange, but if you're in the finance department, so if you're the FD, if you're looking at the bottom line, then the business case is going to be predominantly around productivity. So like, how can we maximize the output of our workforce? That's one thing. How can we reduce absenteeism? Because absent people are people who are not working and are not contributing to profit of the business. So that's a finance department's perspective. The marketing and maybe the talent attraction and retention teams, so recruitment team, will be interested in how do we position things to be a more attractive, be a reputable brand that the next generation of workforce want to come and work for. Because it's less around this race for the best salary, because I'm sure the vast majority of probably millennials, but definitely Gen Z, will say, actually, salary is important. So it's always going to be important to have money to be financially comfortable and financially stable. But a massive thing is, like, do I feel valued by my employer? Are they looking after me? I don't have to work here. I could go and work anywhere. I could work for myself. I could become an influencer. All these other things, because the job market is shifting so rapidly, that you have to be able to position yourself in the best way to attract the best talent. So, as I say, it depends which department you are in terms of where you see the maximum value in doing these sorts of initiatives. But that's going to look different. So you need to have a different narrative for each department. It depends who you're talking to and what their drivers are going to be.
Do the HR department figure in those conversations as well? Are they thinking about occupational health and safety and risk? And are they seeing through that lens yet at all? Do you see?
I'm not seeing that personally. So we have tried to target some of our approach to human resources departments. And I don't know whether their priorities lie elsewhere. Again, I think it might be an education obstacle. So it's only going to mean something and it's only going to feel valuable if you understand what it is that's being proposed to you in the first place. So if the HR department either don't think it's necessarily their remit, or don't understand what value you're proposing it could have to them, then they're not going to buy into it. And I think that is potentially the barrier at the moment, is a lack of education in not even just HR, but in some departments, in terms of understanding what value it can deliver to them in their roles, in their functions.
But clearly one of the drivers is the financial element of this. I mean, you mentioned Joseph Allen. You know, he's quite well known for talking about this 330-300 rule, you know, that so much of your business cost is bound within your people. But also in this knowledge economy that we tend to operate in, the driver for performance are the people. Organizations will spend a fortune optimizing fractions of a percent of performance of various systems within the business. But there's an enormous amount of locked-in potential, isn't there, in the performance of your knowledge base within your organization through things like air quality?
There is. And I think that's a good point, actually, because a huge amount is invested in productivity tools. But it's the software, it's the machines, it's the systems that sit behind and as the kind of core of the business, but from a very system orientated perspective. It's not the people then having to use those tools. So with Meta last year, I think they coined it as their year of efficiency. And you had this blog by Mark Zuckerberg that was talking about how we're going to streamline our processes and optimize our systems and all this sort of stuff. But it was very machine optimization driven. There was nothing about the people in there. And I've read Meta's sustainability reports, 2021, 2022, 2023. In 2021, control find indoor air quality. You find one reference to indoor air quality, and it links to LEED. So as we were saying before in this conversation, LEED is very light touch on indoor air quality, becoming better with how much they're introducing, but still very light touch. And they specifically said that it was going to apply to any building that they took on, either as an owner or an occupier, from 2021 onwards. It's like, I assume the vast majority of their real estate they already had by that point. And then if you look in the 2022 report, control find indoor air quality, nothing. 2023, control find indoor air quality, nothing. So but there is a huge amount around efficiency. And it is quite bizarre that you would be investing so much attention, so much money into optimizing systems that inevitably your workforce will have to use. But if they are not feeling good, if they have sick building syndrome, it doesn't matter how good the system is. It doesn't matter really how automated it is, particularly if it relies on a human to catalyze an automation. There is a fundamental missing piece of the puzzle, and it is bizarre that that just gets looked over. Because when you look at high-performance sports teams and even racing drivers, because the car is so, so fine-tuned, but so is the person driving the car. And so much effort is put into, like, psychologically, how do you feel? What's your nutrition? What's your exercise schedule? How are you sleeping? Workers, you and me in an office, no, we're not dealt with in the same way. But it's businesses want to be high-performing. They want to be highly profitable. But they, for the vast majority of the time, ignore the people that will get them there in a different way to how you would look at a sports team or how you would look at a racing car driver.
Yeah, and as you rightly point out, you know, you can invest quite a bit of time and money in improving the performance of systems, but you then still have to get the workforce to actively engage with those systems to realize the potential of that optimization. If you spend time investing in air quality within a building, all the occupants have to do is breathe when they turn up to realize that performance gain, you know?
Exactly.
So it's an easy win from an engagement perspective. Mm-hmm. So much of the ability to capture performance is locked in to engagement in that process. There's no engagement. There's no engagement in a process of breathing in decent air and being sick less than performing better at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah. And I think particularly with Meta in mind, just because I was looking at this study probably about a year ago, and it took lots of data from GitHub. So anyone who works in software development will know GitHub. For those that don't, Google it. But it is something that lots of software developers use. And this study took data from that, and it took data from individuals' productivity outputs via GitHub and air pollution data across, it was a cohort of 25 or 26,000 developers across 46 countries, four continents. And it basically said, everything else aside, and just looking at productivity output in relation to air pollution, you're losing about 4% output per day, which I think came to like, when they benchmarked all the salaries, it came to like $11 per day. So then I was like, and for the listeners, they're not going to see that I've got my calculator out. But like, if we just did the maths on that $11 a day, so it'd be $11 a day. How many work days are there in a year? 250?
Something like that, yeah.
Let's go with 250. So 250. So for each of those 26,000 people, they're losing $2,750 a year. So times 26,000, I guess it's 71 million. And I'm like, I know that's on a global scale, but that is a huge amount that is being lost through something that is relatively straightforward to control if you understand, first of all, which areas need to be controlled and how to control them. But it's, again, and it's things, it's organizations like Meta, because they have a lot of workforce that is highly skilled, that sort of data is out there to work against and to build the business case around. It's probably just the fact that no one's doing it for Meta at the moment. It's like, we do it in the air quality world and we're like, oh my God, look at these statistics, and we all tell each other about them. But it doesn't really get outside of our realm of interest. It doesn't get to the people at Meta who would make any decisions about this unless you actively try and get to them. But I think that's the problem with all of it, is all of these business cases are so compelling. So it's either the way that we're telling them that isn't resonating, or the people that we're trying to position them to are the wrong people. And I think it's working that out.
Yeah, and framing is so key to building the business case. And I think people's perception, and it's somewhat true, is that it's difficult to prove the outcomes a little bit at the moment. That, you know, that there are research questionnaires that you can put to workforce to try and understand whether their perception of air quality is improved since an intervention, or that whether they feel more productive. And it can feel a little bit disjointed and separated from reality. But increasingly now, there are hard metrics that we're able to use, but particularly depending on the type of work that you do, that can identify, like you were just describing, actual increases in performance for workplaces. And it doesn't have to go as far as health wearables and monitoring individuals within spaces. Just our use and productivity, the amount of data that we're able to capture, if we can segment that and identify that as being a result of an improvement to air quality, it's going to build that business case so much more strongly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think there are plenty of functions, roles, jobs out there where, much like with GitHub, you can quite clearly see output. And actually, in this case, because what's really interesting about these air pollution studies is that it's basically saying, with this one with GitHub, it was saying that software developers weren't slower. That wasn't why there was this loss in output. They were just opting for the easier tasks. Because for whatever reason, and I don't think any of us truly understand what happens with our brains with the influence of air pollution, we just understand that, okay, output goes down. Don't understand what's happening up here, but for whatever reason, when air quality or when air pollution increases, productivity outputs go down. That is the relationship we're seeing with all other factors accounted for. So that's an interesting thing. And then there was a study with the S&P 500, and same day returns dropped by 11.9% with a one increased standard deviation of PM2.5. So particulate matter, air pollution. And that was because the people on these trading floors were more risk averse. So again, it wasn't that they were slower or they were making mistakes. It was just an influence that was happening that was making them more risk averse. So obviously, if you're making lower risk decisions, there's lower reward. But that was why. So I think with software developers, there is a nice statistic or a nice metric to look at for productivity measure. With trading floors, same day returns is a good metric to look at. I agree with you that you don't need to necessarily be looking at wearable devices. You don't need to understand it on an individual level. You just need to understand that on a typical trading floor with this many people, this is the loss of output. And that doesn't need to be looked at in any more granular detail, down to a person. You say this function performs in this way when this is happening. So I think that's a good way to look at it. With other roles, I think it can be slightly more ambiguous, and that's where the only real way it feels like you can get some significant data is by asking about, like, do you feel more comfortable? Do you feel better that we've enhanced our filtration systems? Is something you can't see, but do you feel better now that you've been told about it? So that is more difficult to quantify, but these ones are very straightforward.
Yeah. And that's only part of the picture as well. I mean, there are practical improvements from improved air quality, like absenteeism. So while you may not gain on some performance metric in working processes, you may retain staff more regularly because there's less absenteeism, or presenteeism. I think that's the word for it, and that really clicked with me, actually, is the Jesus people dragging themselves into work, you know, with colds and flus, working at about 30% because they're just not there. You know, there's so many hidden benefits, co-benefits of getting the indoor environment right, you know, beyond, you know, making the right decisions more efficiently.
Yeah. And I think the, because when it comes to absenteeism, obviously you can be absent for a whole number of different reasons. But also maybe you come into the office and you feel fine when you come in. But then if you're exposed to a poorly ventilated place with pretty poor IAQ that would otherwise be classed as a sick building, sick building syndrome will impact you even if you feel fine at the beginning of the day and you come into the office. So that is something that should seriously be addressed, because the amount that the UK economy loses to sick building syndrome is astronomical. I think it's something like 24 million a year. And that was a 2014 statistic. But in all reality, I don't think we've changed buildings very much in the last decade. I mean, most of the ones that were around in 2014 haven't been touched at all. Maybe a refurb of the interior fit out, but probably nothing more than that. So with all of those buildings, they've probably got worse. So I'm sure that number has increased as opposed to decreased, and this is the problem with indoor air quality. Sometimes you can focus, and this is probably what Powell was saying, you can focus too much on the negatives, but you can always spin a negative to form a positive. So it's like, if we address sick building syndrome, then this is how much we could gain back in the economy. So you just reverse it. But I think it's a really important one, because absenteeism, I mean, when we did our AIRN review, so Aerated's annual indoor air quality review, pluggy plug plug plug.
I will put a link into it, by the way, because not only is it beautifully pulled together, there's some cracking information in there as well for people.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I didn't write it, so congratulations to the team. But it is amazing. And I was looking at the statistics of who was surveyed, because I kind of wanted to understand the demographic in terms of, like, the ages of people that were surveyed, just more about the types of people. So I looked at it, and of the 1,400 people that we surveyed across the UK and the US, it said there was a question that they had to fill in. It was, do you have any existing medical conditions that you know are impacted by poor indoor air quality. And a third of people said yes, they did. And I was like, actually, like absenteeism aside, sick building syndrome aside, you've got a third of people, and we randomly selected them. It wasn't like, hey, who's got a medical condition that's impacted by air quality? Come on in, and then we'll just get some others. It was a complete random selection. So a third of those people already, I'm guessing, have to know, would really, really like to know at least about the air quality in their space because it's impacting their health. And then you get those with like a healthy interest that probably make up, I don't know, another 50%. And then you always have those that don't really care very much. But of the volume of people that you've got just in that random cohort that will either realistically need to know or want to know about indoor air quality, it's a huge proportion of them. So then it starts to be like, okay, yeah, we can dwell on absenteeism. But as an individual, if I'm sick, I'm sick. I don't really care that it's impacting the business's bottom line because unless I'm an owner in the business, I'm an employee and I'm sick. So whether I'm sick, that's no fault of the company or whether I've just got sick building syndrome, it's by the by. I'm interested if I've got a medical condition that's impacted by poor indoor air quality, or if I, just because I can control what I eat and what I drink, I also want to know a bit more about the air that I'm breathing, now that I know that that's a thing, then I've got a healthy interest in it. So it, and this is where it kind of, it straddles between the want to know and need to know.
Yeah. And
straddles that line.
And right before the pandemic, it was almost a badge of honor, wasn't it? Dragging yourself into work sick, you know, so like before the pandemic, people didn't even care if they infected other people in the office, particularly. I'm slightly hopeful that that kind of mentality has improved somewhat. I mean, you still hear it. People going, God, I've got a right dose. And you're like, going, well, what are you doing in then? You work from home three days a week.
Get away from me.
We could have done without you for another two. Don't worry. You know, go home, you idiot.
Yeah.
So there's still a little bit of that. But you're right. And it's no surprising that, you know, what is it? One in five people in the UK suffer from some kind of respiratory condition, most of it asthma. Like, it's not going to be a surprise. Yeah. And, you know, add on top of that immune response conditions and allergic reaction conditions, there's going to be a whole heap of people that should want to care about indoor air quality. And in fact, you know, having a conversation with somebody recently, we were saying there's a good chance if you've got a business of 100 people, there's probably half a dozen of them have already got an air quality monitor on their desk in the workplace as it is, you know, so this it's coming whether you like it or not.
Because, I mean, this is, I'm going to say way before COVID. It wasn't way before. It was like 2017. We had an inquiry from someone who said, we're going to need an air quality test because someone in this building has come in with their own air quality monitor and we don't think it's accurate. And when we sat down to have a conversation, being very blunt with them, it doesn't matter if the monitor that's being bought in by an employee is accurate or not. They've got data and you haven't. So if you want to disprove that, then fine. But the fact they've bought it in the first place means that there's probably an issue because they have felt the need to do it. So either they are uncomfortable or they have an interest in knowing more. And it's not the fact that you as an employer or as a landlord aren't being transparent about it. You just don't know about it. And you should know.
Yeah,
in reality now.
And then I'm having these conversations with people across sectors, not only workplaces, but housing and education and so on. It's the fact that they're very difficult questions to answer from employees and tenants and customers when you don't have data and they do. And it's a choice you have to make at some point. Do you get on the front foot on this and get ahead so that you can answer these questions openly and honestly and transparently and start working towards a good outcome, because the road is running out for anecdotal responses for people. You know, within a few years, the vast majority of our built environment is going to be providing us data of the condition of the space that we're in. That's just a fact.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's, I mean, in the US, it's a more litigious society anyway. But there have been a couple of cases that have either, well, most of them have settled outside of court, but have been to do with this, where someone's come in and gathered their own data around indoor air quality. And then the employer's been like, well, let's make this go away because it needs to go away. It would be interesting to know, and obviously in lots of these cases, everyone's anonymized, but it would be good to know whether the employer then did anything off the back of that to address the issue, because it's not just going to be a one-off. Like, yeah, you got caught out once. What's to stop it happening again? You need to have certain measures in place as risk management. And then also when you frame it as risk management to a business, they're like, oh, all of a sudden it's more critical. Because we had a response. I wrote a LinkedIn post about this, so if anyone wants to go and see it, I'll link that too. It was such a visceral response that I had to this email that said that they didn't, this one person, senior management at this one company that will remain nameless, lucky them, where someone in senior management said that indoor air quality wasn't business critical. So, okay, fine. I was like, let me just Google business critical, the definition for business critical. And it's something like the systems and measures that you need in place for a business to be successful. I was like, okay, cool. So the one word there that's calling out to me is successful. So yes, you can have core business operations in place and all these sorts of things and the measures that you need to survive. But survival is not being successful. Being successful is working on your workforce, prioritizing their health and well-being, because you know that you're going to see the feedback from that. And it comes back to this $300 per year per person on payroll. You can have a significant impact on business productivity or on business profitability even if you address that 300 as part of that pyramid. Yeah. So when it came across as not being business critical, I'm like, okay, first of all, my reaction was very red mist. And then I was like, actually, let me explain to you why it is business critical, because maybe that's just being lost in translation. And I appreciate that I'm coming from what looks like a place of bias, because I work in indoor air quality. I have a vested interest in people being interested in knowing more about indoor air quality. But let me explain to you why, for your particular business, I would position this as being business critical. And then would you think it was unreasonable to suggest that this should be part of your strategy going forward, with particular regard to well-being in the workforce, ESG, a whole number of different things? And the response to that was, oh, okay, haven't looked at it that in that way before. Let us bring it up at the next board meeting. And I was like, yeah, great, okay. And now where are we going to go from that? But
and it's amazing how framing, a subtle shift in framing can all of a sudden it resonates. And it can create action. We probably should explain a little bit, because it's the second time we've said 330, 300, that is a real estate metric originally that was used to describe the spend on a building. Comes from the States.
Yeah.
And it's for every $3 you spend on energy, you spend 30 on rent. And for every 30 you spend on rent, you spend 300 on staff costs, remuneration, bonuses, sick leave, all of the stuff that goes with staff. Mm-hmm. And it makes a point, and it was used to great effect by Joseph Allen in his Healthy Buildings book to describe the IRR, if you like, on investing on indoor air quality, that you can work very hard to reduce the energy of the building by 20%. And it may have a fraction of a percentage difference on your bottom line, 0.5% on your bottom line. But a reduction in, even conservatively with a healthy building, 10% improvement in performance across your staff costs will have a double digit impact on your bottom line.
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking. We get used to talking about the 3300 rule, but it's like the structure or the foundation for a lot of the framing that we would use when we talk to businesses about why would you invest in indoor air quality.
In people.
I hope I've explained that clearly for people, but it's quite an important premise, isn't it?
It definitely is. And it's, in some ways, it's a shame that you have to put a price on people, because you would like to think it's in everyone's best interest. Even if you're a decision maker in a business, it is in your best interest to have good well-being initiatives for yourself. Like, you are a member of that business. So you would like to think that everyone's doing it with employee satisfaction and employee well-being at the heart of everything. But the nature of business means that it's probably going to be driven by some sort of commercial gain. So if that's the foot in the door, then that's the foot in the door. Actually, it's fine. It is what it is. And if that's the way in, then get us in and we can do all the good work from there. But we just need a foot in the door to begin with. And I think that's been the mantra for the whole indoor air quality space, has been, okay, it's not enough that we're framing this in terms of health and well-being, because, and this was like pre-COVID, but health and well-being was kind of seen as too fluffy. So then it was, okay, Joseph Allen and John McComa coming in with this is the impact it has on your bottom line. That was more compelling. That was then the foot in the door. So we reverted back to a bit of the health and well-being focused stuff, but actually more of the health and safety and risk management as a result of COVID. But now it's coming back to the economic advantage again. So if that's the foot in the door, get your foot in the door using that message, and then do what you need to do from there to actually exercise the true benefit and the true value of improving indoor air quality.
And your battles with business will be your battles with business to try and prove that business case. But if it's compelling enough, businesses do generally tend to change direction and follow good common sense. The challenge we have within the broader built environment now is creating equally compelling cases for education or for public buildings or for homes, and creating compelling cases that are enough to frame it in a way that people will make changes. I mean, interestingly, I posed that question, I think it was the Yeller or Pavel, I can't remember, but they were saying actually a lot of the criteria that we put in business is very similar to education. Actually, the performance games within education should be enough to build a decent business case for improving air quality in schools. The challenge with schools, obviously, is it's a completely different funding model and not hugely under-resourced. You know, there's very few Deloitte equivalent headquarter buildings within the education sector, bar a few maybe high-level private schools in London. There's not a lot of inward investment into that space, so it has to be framed slightly differently. I was interested to ask you, actually, in the conversations that you're having with businesses, are you still seeing this rebound effect post working from home as a result of the pandemic, of trying to attract people back into the workplace? Because attracting key staff is one co-benefit of air quality, obviously. If I'm going to go for a job and one business has got a decent environment for me to work in and one hasn't, that may influence my decision. Is that conversation still happening with you, the how on earth do we get people back into the office conversation?
I think for us, and I don't know whether this would be the theme across others in the indoor air quality industry, but from our perspective, it's more where businesses are trying to attract people back to the office. It's, yes, it's important, but they'll do more around the layout of the workspace, how to create a collaborative environment. When you're having a meeting, here's the best practices for setting a meeting with the agenda and who you need in the room and who you actually don't need to necessarily be there. Lots of businesses are downsizing anyway, so I think they understand the need for their spaces to work more efficiently. Where air quality comes into the mix is to say, okay, if we're downsizing our footprint, so was it Facebook or Meta, whatever they call themselves now, that we're at One Rathbone Square, and they paid a huge amount to break their lease early because they're downsized and they just don't need that volume of space anymore. But I think the mantra now is, okay, we're downsizing. We don't necessarily have more money to spend, but we are interested in keeping our smaller space as efficient as possible from an occupancy perspective and also from a quality perspective. And thankfully, the indoor environment does feature in that quality conversation. But we're seeing more employers wanting to understand how to transfer this into the home as well, understanding that the home is an extension of the workplace for the foreseeable future, if we're honest. So if you can get people back into the office 3 days a week, and that is like the mandatory policy, then fine. But for the other 2 days where they're working at home, how can we bring those principles of best practice into the home environment as well? So that's more of the conversation is, we've made our peace with hybrid working. Where we have it written into our policy that there's a mandatory requirement in the office, that just is what it is. But where there is then this optional, you can either come into the office for the other 2 days or you can work from home. How can we promote the best working environment in the home setting as well? So it's a positive conversation. It's not wanting to pull people back into the office, particularly if they're reducing the size, because they're not going to want people necessarily on those two optional days to come into the office. So it's all about managing that. But thankfully, the conversations are positive. But it is driven by this efficiency conversation.
I can't remember who coined the phrase, half the space, twice the experience. I think somebody was using that to explain what they were doing with their office space on the basis that they just got rid of a couple of floors. So there is that move, obviously, to try and improve the workplace experience to make it attract people back in. But it's a hell of a Pandora's box you're opening if you're starting to think about people's home working environment, because, you know, for a large part of the knowledge economy, particularly the younger parts of that knowledge economy that are struggling with the cost of rent, struggling with the housing crises that exist all over the world, there are people right now working at the end of their bed in the same room that they went to bed in last night, and that room very likely didn't meet minimum standards for ventilation and regulations last night and isn't now, you know, or they're working in environments where the outdoor pollution isn't great. So opening a window isn't necessarily an option. It's a hell of a threshold for organizations to have to consider crossing someone's home, how you optimize for that, isn't it?
And I think part of it is, let us show you how much better the office is.
Yeah.
So, and in some cases, particularly if it's to do with space, then you get those people who are like, oh my God, I need to get out of this house. I'm going to go into the office. But if someone is relatively comfortable working from home, if they understood that actually if they came into the office, then they were going to feel much better because the office is a much better controlled environment. So all the external pollution that is coming into your home is actually a lot more controlled when it comes in via the mechanical ventilation in the office. Maybe if you're one of these one in three people who has a medical condition that's exacerbated by poor air quality, then you would think, actually, it's probably better for me to go into the office. The conversation that comes up time and again is, well, what does the commute look like? Which goes outside of the realm of indoor air quality, but it does look at, okay, what does the route from my front door to the front door of the office look like? And is that worth it? Because the level of pollution that I'm exposed to on my, let's be honest, probably 1.5 hour, 1 hour to 1.5 hour journey in most cases, how much pollution am I exposed to for that length of time, and knowing that I'm doing that twice a day there and back, is that worth it? And also, would I change jobs based on that? Would I change jobs to somewhere that is in a business park in a leafy area of suburbia instead of trekking all the way into London? And I don't know whether that is going to feature on the radar for changes in location for businesses, because that's mostly driven by rental cost. But I think it's interesting because in the like in the real estate market on an individual level, you see people using the website addresspollution.org because they want to go and look at the external air quality in specific areas. And sometimes a decision to purchase a house does involve, or rent somewhere, does involve air quality as part of that picture. So would it be too much of a stretch to suggest that might be the case for businesses? Maybe, maybe not, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it is an interesting conundrum. And in fact, last year I was involved with a company in Ireland called AmbiSense and mm-hmm. WebEx, and they were trialing the use of indoor air quality sensors in the home through their mm-hmm. WebEx platform to help home workers make decisions about what to do both in their home, but whether or not to go into the office. So it would look at outdoor air quality, indoor air quality at home, indoor air quality in the office. And it would say, mm-hmm. by the way, pollution is increasing outside at the moment. You might want to shut the window. Did you know your office is excellent air quality right now? If you left now, you could jump on the number 22 and be there in five minutes. So you can help through very simple nudges, social nudges, people to make better decisions, not necessarily controlling their indoor environment or being intrusive, but helping them frame and visualize how to make better decisions that ultimately optimize the performance for the occupier. So they trialed that and they actually trialed it. WebEx are fascinating. I don't know if they do it every year, but this time they occupied a island in, I think it was Greece somewhere, and they shove a load of employees out there for a few months.
Oh, great.
And they turn them into guinea pigs. They trial new things with them while they're out there. So they get to work somewhere nice for a few weeks. And one of the trials was this. It was helping people, giving them decisions on whether it's better to be at home or go into the office or whatever it was. It was quite clever. One of the interesting things that's factoring more and more, and I guess you must see it, is the influence that ESG is having on businesses making decisions on inward investment into infrastructure, but also categorizing and labeling the performance of assets. Yeah. I guess that's a very real conversation for you now.
It is. And coming back to that point about getting a foot in the door, ESG is actually a really good vehicle for that,